In 1955, a groundbreaking case takes place in Los Angeles, the first case tried in the United States of a murder while the victim's body is still missing and the suspected killer hasn't confessed. In the years since, this case is frequently referenced, but little is told about the missing woman, Evelyn Throsby, whose life was taken by her own husband. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, one of our ongoing conversations is how it really doesn't matter what woman's story we talk about. You come into these without any information.
Right. Like, unless it's something we covered in the documentary, most of the time I don't know anything about it. I mean, you haven't even really covered anything that I've seen in documentaries, and I watch a lot of those, so...
Yeah, like, this one in particular that we're covering today, like, it's interesting because I only recently found out about this.
Really? So this is one I really won't know.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what you know, but, like...
Well, I know some things. We make it always sound like I don't know anything, but I do know stuff, I assure you.
Well, you're not, like, a true crime
But girly. I'm not a true crime. So I watch any kind of documentary.
Right.
About anything. So, not just crime. Where sometimes people gravitate more towards crime.
And so this story, hadn't heard about it. And so I'm rectifying that for myself. Maybe you've heard about it. Maybe our listeners have. But we're going to be talking today about Evelyn Throsby, who has been missing since 1955. And if anyone goes to Google her after this, you will find her under the name Evelyn Throsby. But as we did in our coverage of Girly Chu's story, I'm leaving off her married name here.
Okay, so 1955. So this is an older case too.
Yes.
Okay.
And so the reason that I'm surprised that I hadn't heard about it, and one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it today, is because when she went missing in 1955, her case was actually absolutely one of those cases that was like a media sensation. So it was front page news, people were talking about it. Actually, when I was looking her up, there are still mentions of this case and her story. So yeah, that's why I was surprised that I hadn't.
Really? Is there, like, a particular reason why hers was so well-known?
Well, we're going to get into that.
Okay.
Right? And we're going to get into, like, why this is, like, largely forgotten and kind of what it means to be missing, but also what it means to sort of be forgotten. So to go from being this media sensation case, like, it's covered everywhere, to how it's largely forgotten now, and I really want to take this time to remember Evelyn and her life and what we know about her. So Evelyn Throsby was born on May 11th, 1892 in New York City. And our New York City listeners can correct me, but she lived on West 125th Street, which I think is in Harlem.
So if it's not, somebody can tell you. You won't be
And I don't think, like, from my Google Street View, I don't think this building exists anymore. But
okay.
Now, a lot of what we know about Evelyn and her case comes from this book by Diane Wagner called Corpus Delicti. And in it, she covers a bit about Evelyn's early life. But I have reason to believe that Diane Wagner's information might not actually be strictly accurate in regards to these, like, early dates and figures. Wagner states that Evelyn and her younger brother, Raymond, were raised by their mother alone after Evelyn and Raymond's father left them to go to Alaska. As one does.
What?
What? What?
Her father left her to go to, them to go to Alaska?
Yeah.
That does seem like a Lifetime movie thing or something, doesn't it?
Like the abandoned family in New York City while dad's off, like, seeking his fortune.
Yeah. In Alaska.
In Alaska. And that may be true, but we do know in the 1910 census, taken when Evelyn was 17, that her mother was listed as a widow. Evelyn is listed as working as a stenographer, and Wagner agrees, but states this was at the Thomas Flying Automobile Company, though I couldn't find a mention of this specific company anywhere.
You can't
know
find
what you're thinking.
The Flying Automobile Company?
Yeah.
I feel like if that existed, you would find it immediately.
Right.
There would be some incredible, like, advertisements or posters from then.
Well, there were definitely, like, flying automobile companies out there. But I didn't find this.
Flying automobile companies, like, just selling a concept?
Well, I mean, it's, like, it's a turn of the century, the obsession with aviation and transportation, and yeah.
But we know those early cars were not coming off the ground.
No. So in her book, Wagner states that Evelyn married in 1916 to Walter Kiernan, but records indicate that she married John Kierman in 1912. So Wagner states that this marriage ended due to alcohol abuse on Evelyn's husband's part less than 2 years later.
Okay, I'm still processing Kiernan and Kierman.
Yes, Kiernan versus Kiernan, Walter versus John. Oh,
so when was this book written?
1984 or 5, yeah.
Is the author still alive?
I don't know.
And you don't think it's accurate?
I mean, we have much more easily accessible records at this point, right? Okay,
so it's not like she was just like merging it with fiction. She just might not have had really great research methods.
Or like easy access to those documents.
Like the documents, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just so the author doesn't come at us, we're not. You did the best you could.
With what well, was and also I could be completely wrong, right?
Or Amy could be wrong. Yeah.
I could be wrong. Now, Wagner then says that Evelyn married Dr. Mirny Lewis, a New York City surgeon.
So this is marriage number two?
Marriage number two.
Okay.
And Wagner says this happened in 1920 and that this marriage lasted 7 years until it also ended due to his alcohol use. In looking at records, I found that she married Dr. Rianne Hartswell in 1919 when he was 41 and she was 26 and that they lived in California.
Okay. So, and was he an alcoholic?
Well, yeah. So I do realize like all of this is confusing, but basically there's discrepancies between Wagner's accounts and the records available that I was looking at. And this actually ends up being an important detail later in Evelyn's story. So I just wanted to like...
Which part? The
husband.
The differences between the husbands in the book and the husband you found?
Yes.
Okay. So the difference between Kiernan and Hartzell.
Right.
No, Lewis and Hartzell. Sorry.
Well, yeah. So far what we have here, to be fine. Clear.
Okay.
So what we have so far is that there's a marriage record for her and John Kiernan in 1912, but I did not find one in 1916 for her and Walter Kiernan.
Okay.
And there is a marriage record for her and Dr. Rianne Hartswell, a doctor in California, in 1919, but not one for her and Dr. Mirny Lewis, a doctor in New York City in 1920.
Okay, and we need to take note of all four of those.
Well, not necessarily them individually, but them in a collection, I would say.
Okay, I can do that.
You know, the reason Wagner says that Evelyn's marriage ended to Dr. Mirny Lewis is because of his alcohol use. So answering your question, there are records of Dr. Rianne Hartswell getting arrested for illegally possessing barrels of whiskey in 1920.
Entire barrels.
Yeah, entire.
The entire barrels. Okay.
Yeah. And so not long after Dr. Rianne Hartswell would have married Evelyn, he is on record being married to someone else. So this is a case maybe of the marriage falling through or a short-lived marriage. You know, I'm not sure.
Okay.
And I might believe that Dr. Mirny Lewis, who I did not find, is fictitious because I can't find records for him. But we do have the fact that Evelyn marries her next husband.
Wait, three?
Three. Yes, husband three.
Three out of a possible five.
Yes, three.
But three.
Three.
Okay.
Husband three, Clarence Petit. And she did so under the name Evelyn Lewis.
Which was number two.
Or maybe number three.
Lewis was number two.
Well.
No, Lewis was Mirny and we don't have a.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my. Okay. Sorry, listeners. We will keep going.
Because there's just a collection.
There's too many men.
There's too many men.
Too many men. And they're not the murdery ones because we're using their whole names.
Yes, they're not the murdery ones. Okay. And this is where Wagner and I start to agree on Evelyn's past, which is with her husband, Clarence Petit, which...
Okay.
Yes.
Is he the husband that we are going to be... That he's going to be, like, the important husband for us?
He's pretty important.
Okay.
But you'll notice I'm using...
don't forget the other ones.
Don't forget the other ones. I am using his real full name, though. So... Okay. So, Clement. Okay. He is... a divorced guy, right? In fact, his first marriage quite spectacularly ended in flames. And I definitely fell into a little research rabbit hole here. But he is the son of Louis Petit of Milwaukee, and Louis made his fortune in salt mining.
Okay.
Locally, Louis...
Wait, do I know who his ex is?
Well, because I did post about
this. Is
that
the part I know?
The Pickle Princess.
The Pickle Princess.
Yes. So we're going to get there.
So I actually supported Clement on this decision he made.
Look at you with your French pronunciation.
I can say it the way you say it.
Clement.
Clement.
Clement. Clement. Okay. So his dad is the salt king.
Okay.
Because of he's worth like an estimated $4 million, which would be like $75 million today.
Okay.
And Clement met a woman who was working in a hotel modeling diamonds and married her. And previously, this is what Vanessa was referring to because I was just fascinated by this as a side story. She had worked in a pickle factory. And so during this process, people in the newspaper referred to her as the Pickle Princess.
So the Salt King's son, we can call him the Salt Prince,
yes,
marries the Pickle Princess. But... she was too wild for him.
Right. Because, okay, one of the really big things, and I'm sure I swear this connects to Evelyn's story, is that Clement is disabled. And sometimes this is attributed to a hunting accident. At other times, it's because of injuries he sustained in a train accident. In either case, he was told by his doctors that to recover his health, he needed to rest. Like, rest cures were very... popular mm-hmm. at this point. His wife, though, she really wanted to be active in the like New York City social circle. She wanted to travel. She wanted to do all that. And so they were really incompatible on the type of life they wanted to lead. And this actually did end up leading to their divorce. And it was in the newspapers. Now, this is why Evelyn, who definitely seems to lead a quieter life, likely seemed appealing to him when he met her. According to Wagner's book, Evelyn met Clement while her husband, who Wagner says at this point was Dr. Mirny Lewis, was undergoing treatment for alcoholism. And after her divorce in 1929, Clement asked her to marry him, but she put him off. She wanted to live independently. The next year, though, they did actually go ahead and get married, and not long after, they moved to Los Angeles in the hopes that the weather there would be good for his arthritis. Together, they purchased land at 261 South San Rafael and built a one-story house on the lot. By all reports, this marriage was ideal, even though when Clement's father died, the fortune he was set to inherit was reduced from millions to substantially less. Clement still showered Evelyn with gifts, including jewelry and the majority interest in the Edgewater, which was a Milwaukee apartment building. So he was like very generous in his gift giving. Living in California also allowed Evelyn to be closer to her brother Raymond, who had already relocated there, and the two saw each other quite frequently. The couple also formed close relationships with other well-to-do residents, and Evelyn had time to volunteer and entertain. So they're living this, like, very kind of not overly lavish, but, like, they're not working.
So it's a nice life, but it seems to be on the... is it still on the quieter, cozier that he needs?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, they're, instead of going to like parties and events and stuff, mostly what they're doing is like having dinner parties with their friends.
So like homey type things.
Yeah. So like they're meeting other couples, having like couples dinner parties, that kind of stuff.
More his speed.
Yeah. At the same time, Evelyn, she's trying to maintain her friendships with those back east, particularly her longtime friend Marguerite, who struggled financially. And to her, Evelyn often sent money and twice yearly packages of gifts that included like clothing, that kind of thing.
It's a like, nice friend.
Yeah, so she would be like, oh, Marguerite, like, I can't use this dress anymore. Could you use it? Mm-hmm. If not, pass it along. You know, like, she tried to make it seem less...
not charitable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, despite their move to California, his health continues to falter. And he ends up passing away on January 18th, 1944, which leaves Evelyn devastated.
That's just, he clearly wins for her number one husband, so it's sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, during this time, she continues to socialize. She makes friends with this woman named Mildred Schuart and her husband. And like Clement, you know, Mildred had severe arthritis and was mostly housebound. So Evelyn would call her up all the time and tell her what was happening out in the world. She would like describe gatherings and like what happened there so that Mildred didn't feel left out. And so she had all these like really close friendships. So after 2 years, Evelyn met and married Norris Mumper, who was a retired engineer who was a consultant to the U.S. Department of State. The two met at a friend's house, and the two ended up marrying in 1946. So, technically speaking, by Wagner's count, this is husband number four.
Four. And this is kind of like by what we've roughly tried to like figure out ourselves would be four.
I think, honestly, he might be number five.
We think Lewis might have been one, because she was using his name.
So Wagner says that Lewis was a husband, but did not include Rhian in the list. And I think she might have married Rhian. So that's the missing one. Yeah.
We don't know. But there's a lot of husbands, but no children.
No children. She does not have children.
So, I mean...
Now, okay, so these two have met, and now Wagner, she describes this marriage as kind and loving, and kind of maybe it was, but looking up Norris in news articles from the time, it states that he had been in Washington, D.C., and was here in L.A. looking for a residence, but he was really unable to find one. Like, basically housing was...
okay.
Hard to find. And he was overheard saying, and this was in the paper, he was overheard saying that he would be willing to marry a girl if she came with a house.
Oh.
And as luck would have it, Evelyn did.
Ugh.
So she had retained the house that she had built with husband number four.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about Norris now.
Yeah, I have some feelings. It makes me feel icky about Norris, but I will say one of the really interesting things about him is that he knew she had her money from her marriage, her previous marriage, and he made it clear that he was not interested in her money at all. She had a stock portfolio of $133,000, and Norris encouraged her to manage and control her own wealth. So he said, "You're a smart woman, you're really capable, and you should be in charge of your own finances." And so she hired J. Smith Miller to act as her broker. And Miller says that his interactions with Evelyn were, yes, pleasant, and that she had a good understanding of her finances and money management.
Okay, so he just wanted a place to live, but he's not an entire mooch.
No, he's, yeah. So now, during this marriage, Evelyn becomes close with her sister-in-law, Opal, and also Norris's children from a previous marriage. His son, Bill, and his wife, Dorothy, were having a hard time finding their own housing in L.A., right? So Evelyn makes this suggestion. Why don't you build a second house on her lot and then just live there permanently?
Does this end up becoming a good idea?
Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, so they build the house, they move in, but within a few days of them moving in 1948, Norris actually dies of a heart attack. Yeah.
Okay. So now she's just got this family living on her land.
Right. And she kind of like, you know, she's dealing with her second husband's death, like, you know.
Third?
Well, yes, the second husband who's died.
The second one.
The second husband who has died. And she kind of like goes... she takes some time off and goes elsewhere, etc. So she's not necessarily like on this property with her. But it is an awkward situation,
yeah.
I would think. But, you know, I think they were all close. They all appreciated each other, right? So you have two of her husbands who've died like in quick succession, right? And Evelyn, she kind of goes into a bit of a tailspin. Like, A few years prior, she did have some skin cancer that had been removed. And after this happened, she kind of got really obsessive with like her skincare. Like she would like go to the doctors all the time to have them check, right? Because she got kind of like paranoid. And eventually they just had to be like, stop, you are fine, right?
Which for that time, it would have been really good that like it was all taken care of.
Yes. Yeah. Now, other than that, though, Evelyn's just sort of continued her everyday life. She'd inherited money and stocks and property and more from both of her husbands. And that like enabled her to kind of indulge in her passions, which were like travel and volunteerism. She also had time to and the ability to hire employees like a gardener and a secretary named Olive, who handled Evelyn's correspondence and kind of served as like a live-in companion. And that's when Evelyn meets her next husband.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to laugh, but I can't keep up. I love Evelyn, but yes, there's so many men. And it's not her fault because like they're dying.
Oh, well,
or yeah. Becoming alcoholics. Yeah. She's lost several to alcoholism, several to death.
Yeah.
So this is not her fault. But at the same time, even Evelyn had to have like been giggling to herself at this point.
I don't know. Like my grandmother, she drew the line at three. She was like, I can't do this anymore. Yeah, but Evelyn's just like, we're doing it. So at 57, Evelyn is attending a summer garden party hosted by one of her friends, Roy Wilcox's. And there she meets Elle.
Great.
Right. Oh, because I used his initial.
Is it only an initial?
Yeah.
So this is not good.
No.
This is the worst husband.
Oh, yeah. He's so stereotypically bad. I don't know. Did we base some of our stereotypes off of a man like him? I think so. So.
Oh, really? He's like cartoon criminal bad?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So now he's one of the other guests that evening, and he's like a few years younger, I think 4 years younger than Evelyn. Though you wouldn't guess it by looking at the photos of the two. Like she definitely looks younger than him. And he basically like just love bombs Evelyn.
He what?
Do you know what love bombing is?
No.
No.
That sounds nice. Is it not a nice thing?
I mean, the love part, yeah, but not the bomb.
But I mean, there are like good bombs too, like bath bombs. And...
No.
Okay.
So love bombing is basically when it can happen in any type of relationship, very often romantic relationships, hence love bombing. But basically it's like when you meet someone and they're like the best person ever. They're interested in the same stuff as you. They're buying you things. They're calling you all the time. They're just like the best of the best, right?
Still sounds nice.
Yeah. But then they change.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that's like a lie. That's a facade.
That's a facade, right? So like once they have you in their orbit, they drop all that.
So they know they're not a great person. So they're just like pretending to be.
Right. Like they try to be like this like ideal person. Okay. Right. So
he's a liar. Essentially.
Yeah. So he does this to Evelyn. Like he's asking her questions, giving her compliments. He's connecting to her interests. This is like the first meeting. Like she loves travel. Like, oh, hilarious. Cause like he does too.
Like right? What a coincidence.
Yeah.
Oh no. Okay.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And so after the party, he immediately inserts himself into her life. He's calling her. He's taking her on lunch dates. He's telling her how he can't wait to see her again. Like, he is doing the, like, utmost here. And so by August, he's asking her to drive with him through northern Mexico. And while he's there, he proposes to her.
So we're still in the love bomb phase.
Yeah. So, like, very often... Not every whirlwind romance is like this, but lots of the ones that are just ends up being like this. Like you're in this like moment where everything's so great and wonderful, right? And so it's not exactly clear at this point how much Evelyn actually knows about her new husband. He depicted himself as successful and wealthy, and he inserted himself into those kinds of privileged social classes in LA. In reality, though, he only had $3,000 in the bank. He drove practically a decade-old car. He lived in a single room at a private members club. And he worked in house paint sales. And so Evelyn as a widow with a reasonably sizable fortune, was like the perfect mark for him.
So he knew she was wealthy?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yuck.
Yeah. And it feels like he really inserted himself in those social circles really to kind of meet with women like Evelyn.
It's a real dirtbag move.
Yeah. And so, to be clear, the two of them, they get married in Mexico, and then they followed up a few weeks later with a ceremony in Nevada. And what Evelyn experiences next are pretty much textbook abuse signs, right? Elle goes to work immediately to isolate her from her substantial and dedicated social network. I mean, these are the people who were there through her husband's death, her health scare. These are the people she went to dinner parties with and she checked with on a regular basis. And so in the first month of their marriage, he convinces her to sell her home in Pasadena, the one she had built, the one that her son-in-law was like living on, right? And they end up moving an hour's drive away to Bel Air, and they lived in this house at 217 North Bentley Avenue. So he's socially isolating.
Okay, so she's, yeah.
And so then her live-in maid, Vera, would later say that she would hear arguments between the couple, and at one point she sees a mark on Evelyn's cheek. And according to Vera, Evelyn said that she fell when she asked her about it. But later, Elle approached Vera and asked her what Evelyn had told her. And when Vera said, well, like, Evelyn told me she fell, and Elle replied, no, she didn't fall. I just slapped the wind out of her, and that's all there is to it.
So he's, like, really humiliating, too.
Yes, like, he wants it known.
That he did that.
Yeah.
Ugh.
And later, Elle would tell Vera that he hadn't married Evelyn for love, just for her money. So he's telling the maid this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he also asked Vera to eavesdrop on Evelyn's phone conversations and to look through her mail.
She doesn't, does she?
No, she's okay. Like, absolutely refused. And she later claimed that after that happened, after she turned him down, one night she woke up to find her bedroom door firmly closed and the valve to the gas heater in her bedroom opened up.
So he tried to kill her because she didn't listen?
Yeah, that's like what she thinks happened.
Yeah. Did she quit?
She didn't, because she was really dedicated to Evelyn.
Okay.
And she suspected him, but she didn't have proof. But still, like, she's not going to spy on Evelyn. And unsurprisingly, Vera was let go shortly after. Elle basically makes Evelyn fire her.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So at this point, we know that Elle is abusing Evelyn by isolating her, physically abusing her, but he also quickly moves to the next step, which is financial abuse. He pressures her repeatedly to give up her access to her accounts. Though her investments and holdings, she receives like what would be today close to $200,000 a year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that's like she's living off of the dividends of those, right? And it's not necessarily a huge fortune, but it does allow her to live her life quite comfortably, and it allows her to travel. And what Elle wants her to do, as he told basically anyone who would listen, is to move Evelyn to an all-cash position. And so Evelyn doesn't want to do that, right? So her financial advisors said, like, that's not a wise move, and they don't want her to do that either. If she did, it would mean the end of her yearly income. Right. But even so, Evelyn really feels kind of powerless to stop him, and she really does not want to argue with this man. Elle eventually gains control of her stock portfolio, which accounted for at least half of Evelyn's yearly income, and he reduced her shares so much that by 1955, her income from that dropped to $0.
None of this makes sense, though, because he married her for the money.
Yeah, but she's like, she needs to be alive and well.
Okay.
To be making that money and married to him. Like, see, he's only benefiting when he's married to her, right?
Right.
You so she that? Has a yearly income. But if she sold everything, she would have a bunch of cash all at once.
So he's not setting her up for the long term. He's setting himself up for right now. It just doesn't make sense. Like, yeah, makes sense for him, but not. It does not make sense,
obviously. It does not make sense for Evelyn, right?
No.
Okay. Now, her friends are not exactly thrilled with any of these developments in Evelyn's life. Socially, her female friends, they don't trust him, especially in light of the fact that he moved Evelyn so far away from them. The husbands in their social circle, they were largely successful businessmen, and they were aware, at the very least, that Elle wasn't as knowledgeable as he claimed to be, right? Some of them even said they would see, like, him steal tips from the waiters.
Really?
After, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Evelyn's brother, you know, the one she was so excited to move to California to be with and to see, like, he thought Elle was pretty shady, and he tries to tell Evelyn this, but this causes a rift between him and Evelyn. So she doesn't...
So her brother and her is damaging the relationship at this point. It's damaging,
yeah.
Okay.
And, like, for her part, Evelyn really doesn't want to speak poorly of her husband to anyone. So her brother saying this is just, like, upsetting to her, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Elle was consistently belittling Evelyn, even to her own family and friends. He painted her as incompetent, basically unable to manage her own finances, and he started to claim that she had health issues, even anger issues.
It just doesn't seem right because she's, you know, she's old enough that her character can't change that much. Like, she's in her 50s at this point, late 50s.
Yeah, so he's
like,
just
you wouldn't
there.
Just all of a sudden change character. So, like, the people around her know what's happening.
Yeah, so, like, they're not...
It's pretty clear.
...buying it.
Yeah.
They don't like him.
Right.
Like, he's universally disliked.
Well, and these people have also seen her with other husbands, and she was fine.
Yes. Right.
So.
Now, okay, we are up to May 11th, 1955.
We're talking dates.
We're talking dates. A group of Evelyn's friends hosted a dinner party for Evelyn's 65th birthday. They host it at the Beverly Hills Supper Club. Now, Elle was there apparently telling everyone who listened that he and Evelyn had plans to move abroad. And her close friend, the Bronners, would later say that Evelyn looked relieved as the party came to a close, but she told them when they asked that she was just tired. On May 15th, the Bombs, two of Evelyn's other friends, like, she definitely makes friends with, like, couples. They host a birthday party for Evelyn, and she tells Gladys Baum that Elle wanted them to go to Europe, where they would travel around by car in Spain and Germany. Now, Evelyn, in this conversation with Gladys, she does mention that she had diverticulitis.
Diverticulitis. Okay. Perfect. So she has...
Diverticulitis, which, okay, in basic terms, inflammation or infection of the digestive tract wherein pouches can form. Now, this can be quite serious.
Yeah.
Okay, but Evelyn says she's feeling well. She's managing her condition with anti-inflammatory medications. These are prescribed by her doctor. She's going to be okay. And so she feels like her health is up to par for this kind of trip. And she'd even started getting her traveler's checks lined up.
And she's doing all this voluntarily?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Now, on May 16th, Ulrich Quast.
This is a name.
Ulrich Quast.
Okay.
He is a Mercedes-Benz car salesman.
Okay. So I'm trying to stick with you here.
You're like, we went from a party.
We have, like, so many weird things just coming up. Like, okay.
Okay.
The Mercedes-Benz salesman.
Right.
Ulrich. Okay.
He's bringing a Mercedes-Benz 220S to Evelyn and Elle's house for them to test drive. Which is very, like, full service, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, they tell him their plans are to purchase a 220S and pick it up in the factory in what was then West Germany. And their plan was to drive around Europe in this car and then ship it back to the United States when they were done.
Did people do this kind of thing in the 50s?
Yeah. So I guess, like, it was like $200 US to get it shipped. You know, you can actually still do this now with Volvo.
But does it seem practical?
I would do it. Like, just drive around with my Volvo in Europe for a little bit.
And then just keep it? It's like a souvenir?
Yeah, I feel like Volvo, can you want to sponsor me? I don't know. But,
Volvo, okay. Amy needs a trip in a car.
Yes, okay. But yes, they did do this. They still do this.
People do it.
People do it, yeah.
So weird.
We'll be back in a moment.
Okay, now, Evelyn and Elle, they already have two cars, which is his 1940 Ford and her 1948 Dodge. So if you're wondering, that does mean that the last time Evelyn would have purchased a vehicle was during the time that she was married to Norris. So now 1955. It just seems
is
weird
Norris
to me.
Is the first one that died or the second one that
second
died?
Second one.
Okay.
It just seems weird to me that like a woman with like supposedly this much disposable income would...
Not buy a new car?
Not buy a new car. And then like the last time was with her other husband. Like, seems sus to me. But now, anyway, Elle and Ulrich Quast, they start to have a disagreement. Elle wants Quast to take one of their cars as a trade. But Quast says they didn't really do that, and the best option for them was to do like a private sale of the vehicle. And Elle was not happy with this answer. Additionally, Elle decides he wants to pick up the car in Spain and not West Germany. And Quast says, like, due to all the paperwork, that's not going to work.
Okay.
And so Quast gets them to test drive the vehicle, and everything seems to be going well. And Quast notes that it's around 4:21 p.m. It's the last time he checks his watch, and they're ending their test drive.
Okay, so they're still in the States. They're doing the test drive with Quast here.
Yep.
And now it's 4:21.
Yep. And so Quast says, hey, I'll call you on Thursday, and we can, you know, I'll give you all the details and numbers and everything you need to make a decision.
Okay.
Okay, now, the next day, May 17th, Evelyn was supposed to go to her hair salon. She had a standing Tuesday appointment at 9:30. So every week she has this appointment at 9:30, and she's maintained this time for years. Are you processing someone getting their hair done?
I am processing that. It's just, who has time? Well, I guess she's in her late 50s, but... who has time?
Well, so it's important to know, like, Evelyn's life is, like, she doesn't have to work, right?
Would you do it, though, even if you did have time and you could?
I mean, I would probably have some sort of other standing appointment.
Right. Maybe massage or something.
Right. But, like, yeah, so she gets her hair done once a week, which was actually, you know, more fairly typical in the 1950s,
so too.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So she's got this standing appointment, but an hour before this appointment, a man calls and cancels the appointment, which really shocks the stylist. Because, again, years.
Obviously, Elle.
Yeah, well,
are we going to talk about that later?
No, but I mean, it's obviously.
Obviously. Okay.
Now, the stylist knows how much Evelyn enjoys this. She's really trying to process this. But when she expresses this shock, the man confirms that this appointment was canceled. And not only that, but all future appointments are canceled as well.
Weird. And why does he cancel at all? Why doesn't he just, like, not let her show up?
Right. I mean,
isn't it weird for him? Like, obviously he did something to her at this point. We're talking dates. We're talking, like, down to times and everything.
Right.
Isn't it less weird for her to just not show up than for him to be calling and being like, yeah, this is the last, like, she's not coming to this one or anymore ever?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think he's trying to prevent the hairstylist from, like, contacting or calling anyone. But
the hairstylist
time, like,
obviously did tell somebody
still,
this.
Is still shocked. Yeah, I mean, this comes to light later. At the time, she was just like, that's weird.
But at least she has something to go with because he called. Because otherwise, she would have been just like, yeah, she didn't show up. End of story.
Right, yeah. Now, we're up to Thursday, May 19th. Elle tries to enter Evelyn's safe deposit box at Security First National Bank in Westwood. And he has with him a signed note that he claimed was Evelyn giving him, like, rights to the box. Because at this point, she's the box's sole owner. And though Elle had the key, the bank was like, no, you can't have access.
Good for them.
Yeah. But he keeps arguing until finally they're like, okay, fine. Yeah. Fine. You can go in. That Thursday, Quast, the Mercedes guy, he calls to close the sale, but Elle says they were no longer interested in placing an order. And Quast would later say that Elle told him that the reason was because Evelyn got suddenly ill and would need to go back east for treatments.
Okay.
And then over the next few days... heavily, but, you know, throughout the next few months, over the next few days, he's traveling around to different banks, opening accounts in him and Evelyn's names, and, like, depositing those traveler's checks that she had gotten. and they had her name signed on it. He also transferred some of her bank balances. He deposited her monthly check. He's canceling the insurance coverage on some of her jewelry that she had gotten during her marriages. And he even sold his car and started driving Evelyn's car.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So money starts moving around, right? Now, during this time, Evelyn's friends were trying to get a hold of her. Despite the fact that she had moved so far away, Evelyn spoke to them regularly on the phone. The actress Jeanette McDonald was among one of Evelyn's closest friends, and she said that she called and Al answered. And he told her that Evelyn was out and that he'd give her a message. But Jeanette never received a call. And so she keeps on calling and her calls just go unanswered. Right.
So something's really up at this point. Yeah. But Elle is just, I do not understand what he's doing, I guess.
Well,
he's lacking logic.
Yeah, it's getting weirder too. So Evelyn's friend, Gladys, she tries. Now, Gladys usually talked to Evelyn several times a week, but like Jeanette, her calls also go unanswered. And she tried actually for several weeks calling her friend, but she eventually gave up and started calling her mutual friends instead to be like, what is up with Evelyn?
Well, yeah.
Now, among the friends, many thought that Mildred, so this is the woman who had arthritis, who Evelyn really connected with.
Okay, the woman who's housebound?
Yes.
Okay.
She's not fully housebound because she is away.
But kind of like the first husband that died.
Yeah, yeah. Like, Come on. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she actually is away during much of this time. She's on a European trip. So she's well enough to go on this European trip. I don't know.
Okay.
Right. Now, all the friends kind of agreed that like Mildred would be the person who might know something or be able to figure out something. And so they're kind of like, let's wait for Mildred to get back. Now, Mildred gets back on June 15th. And the very next day at 7:45 in the morning, Mildred gets a strange phone call. And it's Elle.
Elle calls Mildred.
Yes.
At 7:45 in the morning.
Yes.
Randomly. Okay.
Yeah.
The day after she gets back from Europe.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Right. He tells her, so he's telling Mildred that he's been up all night with Evelyn and that she's physically and mentally unwell. He even claimed that Evelyn was right in that moment, in her bathroom, completely naked, holding a bottle of whiskey and kind of uttering obscenities.
Do we even believe that Evelyn's alive at this point?
No.
Yeah.
But, like, this is what he's telling
Such
Mildred.
A weird story.
So, like, Mildred is, like, fast asleep and just, like, imagine her getting this phone call and then just being told that her best friend is, like, naked and, like, ranting and drinking whiskey.
But, okay, so seriously, though, if that happened and the husband was calling the best friend for support, wouldn't he be like, here, you try talking to her?
Yeah.
And pass her the phone?
No. So instead, Mildred's like, you know, this doesn't sound like her. And he's like, oh, it is, right? He's insisting. And then he says that he needs to send Evelyn to a sanatorium on the East Coast. And then he basically tells Mildred that he wants her to keep this between the two of them. And that if her other friends ask for her to say, like, you know, she's going away for treatment for her diverticulitis, right?
Yeah. But that's not, like, I don't know. It's almost like he's setting her up to be like, so I heard she's losing her marbles.
Right.
Like, I feel like he's, like, a 1950s guy with 1950s ideas of, like, what it looks like when a woman actually is, like, having a breakdown. So yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, she'd be naked. She'd be walking around muttering stuff. She'd be drinking. And then, like, oh, and then thinking about, like, what would the other woman say? Oh, yeah, well, like, if I told one this gossipy thing, then it's going to get around. Like, we've got, like, a lot of, like, kind of sexist notions of what.
Oh, it's going to get worse, too.
Oh, okay.
Now, by mid-July, her friends and family, they're getting more desperate. Opal, who is Norris's sister, and
I can't keep track of these people. Is Norris number three? No, Norris is number four. Norris is the second one to die. Right.
Yes. And so Opal actually, so that's Norris's sister. She had actually purchased Evelyn's property in Pasadena. You know, so she was living there. But anyway, Opal is like, I'm concerned about my former sister-in-law, right? Mm-hmm. So she takes an acquaintance with her and they just show up at Evelyn's house. They are done with trying to call, right? Now, no one answers the door, and while the women are trying to decide what to do, they look up and they see L standing in one of the windows, and he's just staring at them, twirling his glasses in his hand.
That's not unsettling.
Right. And so he doesn't acknowledge them, and so after a while, the women are like, we'll just leave.
Yeah.
And so they end up really more, like, perplexed and concerned than when they got there, right?
So weird.
Yeah. So this continues on throughout the summer. When people are able to talk to L, he gives them really varying answers. Sometimes it's that Evelyn is out, and sometimes it's that she's in a sanatorium. But just, like, no one hears from Evelyn, though. So by late July, L throws his own dinner party.
No!
Yeah. And he's invited his friends, the Grannises, to dine with him. And they bring along with them Harriet Livermore. Now, some people might recognize Harriet's name because she just happens to be the widow of Jesse Livermore, who is perhaps most widely known by his nickname, which is the Wolf of Wall Street.
Wasn't that a movie at some point?
Yeah. So he was, okay. Jesse Livermore is like
that guy.
The real.
Yeah, I did not see the movie, but.
I did not see the movie either, but Jesse Livermore is like.
Okay. And this is.
His
Jesse
widow.
Livermore's. Okay, so Jesse's dead.
Jesse's dead.
Yes. And Harriet went to dinner with the
Grannises and Grannises. L.
Okay. Why is he throwing dinner parties?
Well, it's because Harriet. Now, Harriet is just the kind of woman L is looking for. Another wealthy widow he can kind of prey on, right?
I was wondering.
Yeah, so he sets his sights on her and basically begins his love bombing technique all over again. He's taking her to parties, inviting her out. Yeah.
But this is all while his wife is supposedly in a sanatorium.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And she's just... Harriet!
Well, okay, so...
Come on.
Hold on a second. So in August, he takes her on a candlelight dinner and drive. And Harriet is, she's pretty astute. I know you're feeling a little doubtful.
I don't want to judge Harriet, but at the same time, come on.
Okay. So she starts to realize that he's really avoided telling her anything about himself. Now, when they first met, he told her his first wife died and that his second wife, Evelyn, abandoned him. So that's what she thinks has happened.
Okay.
And so she starts asking him on this drive about Evelyn. L tells Harriet that Evelyn sent him out on an errand, and then when he got back, she was just gone.
Okay, so no breakdowns, no sanatorium, no...
No, it's just that she suddenly leaves him.
Okay.
Okay, but even so, Harriet is like, this is strange.
Yeah.
She thinks it odd, not that a woman would abandon her husband. I mean, Harriet's been married a few times.
Mm-hmm.
But that she would so readily abandon her friends like that.
Okay.
Right. And when she presses Elle on this, he claims that Evelyn had done this kind of thing before, abandoned him at a hotel when they traveled to Chicago together. He says that they arrived for their trip and then basically she left and then reappeared on the last day saying that she was ready to go home.
Really?
Yeah. And Harriet's like,
Yeah.
Right. And so L adds that he believes that.
Are we pausing for dramatic?
I hate this man so much. He says Evelyn's a lesbian.
And that explains everything.
Right. And that she abandoned him in Chicago to have an affair with a woman there.
Now, this is not the first woman that's been accused of, like, trying to have affairs with women in some of the stories we've talked about. And when I say some of them, I mean, like, the one that happened just at 9/11, which wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, so there's this...
In relation to them. Like, but or almost, like, putting as, like... First off, she's having an affair, but it makes it even more evil because she's having an affair with a woman.
Right. Instead of like...
Like, what's the difference? You're cheating, male or female.
Yeah. Like, and so it's like this way to like make you feel some sort of way about the person. It's just like, I don't know. Like, why are we even questioning people's sexuality? But like in 1955, he's like trying to paint her as like someone who just isn't very honest. Right.
Right.
And that there's something...
She's like an unsavory character.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is actually was used in 2001. So like.
Right. So not that long ago, this is still being used against women. And like I said, I really don't know what makes it better in a man's mind or worse. Like, obviously just cheating in general is bad. So why do we need to pull in that, like, she cheated on me and it was with a woman? Like, that makes it so much worse. In my mind, it actually would make it better. Because it's like, well, she cheated because you're a dude. Sorry, she just doesn't like them anymore. But it's not like, I don't know why being a lesbian is such like a villainous thing.
Well, I mean, I think that this, whether it's happening in 1955 or 2001, is just the ways in which homophobia, right, is so imbued in our understanding of the world, right, that basically they're using this as a way to also just say, these people, there's something wrong.
They're deviants.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we can recognize that as like homophobic, but also like the fact that it's happened in 1955.
It's also just wildly sexist.
And like, it's, yeah.
Come on.
Right. So it's just this horrible, like he's weaponizing sexuality against her.
Yeah.
Right. And Harriet is like, what the heck? Right.
Mm-hmm. As she should be.
Yeah. So she's like, hey, you know, if you don't like your wife, if you're making these claims about her, why don't you just divorce her?
Exactly.
And he's like, well, I'm going to wait the 7 years needed to declare her dead.
Is that a real thing?
Yeah.
You have to wait 7 years to declare someone dead?
So, yeah, there's amount of time will vary, but like there's usually an amount of time that if someone's gone missing that you can then declare them dead, right? So he says he's waiting for that point.
Huh.
Now, luckily, Harriet is like, this is all she needs to know, because I feel like Harriet's kind of a girl's girl here.
Mm-hmm.
She's just ending things with Elle, and he tries for weeks to get her back. But at this point, like, he's given her the ick, like,
I like Harriet. So yeah. And Harriet's street smart.
Not budging. I feel like I'm going to dive more into like Harriet's history later. Then hopefully she doesn't disappoint me. But yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, another woman, Marianne Beeman, she does become completely enamored with Elle when she met him through mutual friends later that summer. Now, Marianne, she's 46. She's divorced. But unlike Evelyn or Harriet, she's not financially well off. She works at a dental office as sort of like a receptionist. But still, she's believing everything Elle tells her. He's buying her gifts. He's taking on dates. And like, she's just in.
Why is he even after her if she has no money?
I think in some ways also, she's like dramatically younger. I think.
Oh my God. So she's just like a prize?
Maybe, right? And so 1955 fades to a close without anyone seeing Evelyn.
Wow, that still all happened in 1955.
Yeah.
It's a busy year.
Right. So during this time, it's not that people weren't onto him, and the town was definitely alight with gossip. Even a friend of Harriet's ran into Harriet later that summer, and they said, hey, everyone's talking about how he might have killed Evelyn.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, see, it's like, Evelyn, I can see her getting sucked into it because there wasn't any, like, backstory. And then Harriet comes along. Now there is, like, this little bit, like, whoa.
Yeah.
And she knew. Mm-hmm. So she backs off. But Marianne, we do know she stays right in it.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So behind the scenes, what's happening in 1955 and into early 1956 is that there are some investigations ongoing. And these kinds of rumors are making it to the police. It wasn't until February 13th, 1956, that the police brought Elle in for questioning. And this is after they spent an extensive amount of time looking at Evelyn's finances and for Evelyn herself. Now, they brought him in late at night, around 10 p.m., to kind of unsettle him. And they questioned him straight through the night into the next afternoon. They're trying to figure out what's
up. They're breaking him down, right?
Yeah. He does say, he voluntarily says that on May 16th, 1955, the two of them did test drive the Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
From there, he said, Evelyn asked him to go buy tooth powder. Because
toothpaste type?
Yeah.
Yeah,
but okay. It was a powder form.
So fun.
Uh-huh. From the store. And when he returned, she was just gone.
Okay, so he was sent on an errand and she disappears.
Yeah, which matches the story he was trying to tell Harry.
Kind of, yeah.
Now, the investigators knew that Elle had been telling people that Evelyn was in a sanatorium, and when they asked him about this, he said he never told anyone this.
He told Mildred.
Right. And he then claimed that around this time, Evelyn had been drinking heavily and that maybe she did need medical help. They asked why she would have left without her money, and he claimed she had withdrawn $15,000 from their bank account, claiming that he had allowed her to put all of the assets in her name. So they're like, I thought you didn't have money. And he's right. Like, no, I just put it under her name and she took it.
No.
I mean, this is also hilarious for a man who didn't have any income to claim on his own tax returns.
Yeah. Okay.
So despite their suspicions that there's something going on, there's no clear evidence of where Evelyn was or what happened to her. And when Elle was brought in for questioning a month later in March, he said that he thought he was Evelyn's third husband. But later he learned he was her fifth, which is true. Or maybe her sixth, which
or
is what
fourth.
I suspect.
Fourth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so sixth. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, he then said he thought she might have checked herself into a sanatorium, but he didn't know which one that would be.
Mm-mm.
So the next day, they start searching his house, and it's then he starts telling investigators that he believes his wife is a lesbian.
If she was a lesbian, she went to marry six men.
Right. So he's like really digging in on this angle that she's got secrets, that she's keeping it from people, right? But while he's chatting it up with the investigators, Police Sergeant Art Hurdle, he's combing through the backyard. He first focuses on an incinerator. Those were used to dispose of trash in people's backyards. And he's concerned that maybe Evelyn might have been placed in one. But while he's there, he remembers a case he'd been on a year before about a man who murders his wife and buries her in the neighbor's yard. So he hops over the wall into the neighbor's yard and starts looking around. And there, among some leaves, he finds a tooth and then a partial dental plate. Then he found what looks like to be some partially dissolved medications, some tooth powder, a tube of hair product, and several feet away, two pairs of glasses.
This is a weird bunch of stuff.
It is a weird assortment of things.
Mm-hmm.
Hurdle later brings the dental plate to Evelyn's dentist, who confirms, yes, that is her dental plate. And then her eye doctor confirmed that the glasses were also hers and that she had picked them up only a few weeks before she disappeared. Her hairstylist confirmed that Evelyn used the same hair product to maintain her style between her weekly appointments.
It's her stuff then.
Yeah. So it's clear that something had happened to Evelyn and Elle had been involved, right? So I think they're under no illusions here, right? But by May and into April, Elle was testifying in front of a grand jury about Evelyn, about his financial dealings regarding her accounts. On April 27th, he was indicted on 13 charges of fraud, which included 9 counts of forgery and 4 counts of grand theft, basically for moving her money around and stealing her money, right? And forging her name. So on May 3rd, they were going to go to the second part of the grand jury to see if they could move forward with an indictment for murder. But in the meantime, he's out on bail.
Okay.
And on May 2nd, the day before that's supposed to happen, Elle is gone. Not even his girlfriend, Marianne, knew where he had gone. A massive search is launched and wanted posters featuring his face were posted across the country. In October of 1956, despite his absence, Elle was actually indicted for the murder of Evelyn.
Good.
Yeah. Meanwhile, though, for about a year, he's hiding out in Canada, specifically in Ontario.
That's not far from here.
No.
That's so, yeah.
Yeah. And to be clear, his photo is posted around the province, but like no one's recognizing him.
Well, so Amy did show me a picture of him.
Yeah.
And he just looks like Guy.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't look like anything distinct.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, Al, though, I get the sense he's extremely full of himself, so he likely thought it would be perfectly fine if he just popped down to the U.S. to purchase a car.
Mm.
And he does that in April 1957. Now, today, if you want to go to Canada, like in and out, you're stopped at a border crossing, like everyone is stopped, mm-hmm. right? But in 1957, this really does actually seem to be a bit more sporadic and haphazard. But on Monday, April 15th, he's heading through the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel, and he's immediately recognized by an immigration officer, Officer Everett Bale, at a customs checkpoint. Bale is like, oh my God, I've seen this face before,
mm-hmm.
right? And so he manages to convince Al to enter their permit office under the guise of needing to do some extra paperwork for this new car that Al has purchased, right? But what he's really hoping to do is just confirm that that's him. On April 16th, under questioning by the FBI, Al finally admits what his real name is, and he's sent back to LA to face what is now 14 indictments.
He should have just gotten a car in Ontario.
Yeah. Like, dude. Right. Now, the trickiest part about this case is, though, it's clear that Evelyn is missing and that her personal effects have been found. No one has found Evelyn. The prosecution was going to attempt to try this case without her body. Now, this isn't necessarily unusual now. In fact, hundreds of cases without bodies have been tried in the U.S., most of those actually happening since 2000. These cases require proof that the crime occurred, and we've covered several missing persons cases at this point where a DA's office just basically backs off of a case because the burden of proof is so high and it's considered risky, right?
Mm-hmm.
Still, though, 86% of murder cases tried without bodies have led to convictions compared to the general murder conviction rate, which is 70%. But when Evelyn's case comes up, at this point, it is unusual. It's not that cases without bodies hadn't happened before in the United States, but until this specific case, they had been accompanied by a confession of some sort. And so at this point, though, there is no way that Elle is convincing. So this is historic and groundbreaking. And the trial is lengthy. Much of Elle's defense is the fact that there isn't a body, so there's no proof that she's dead. They suggest again and again that Evelyn had medical and mental health issues, that her friendships with female friends were too close.
Mm.
And therefore suspect, that she had at one point had a live-in secretary that's also used against her, right? And in many ways, it seems like kind of Evelyn's on trial. They even suggested that Evelyn might have been poisoning her husband.
This is all crazy.
Right? And so the prosecution, though, they're bringing witness after witness. Evelyn's friends and family, they all are speaking about her relationship to Elle. Financial advisors and representatives who could speak about her financial situation under Elle, doctors who recognized Evelyn's personal items, and then the defense, they're bringing witnesses who claim that, like, those witnesses saw her alive somewhere to try to convince jurors of the possibility that she's still alive. It is.
It's all, like, kind of wild, like, the story that they're making. But at the same time, wouldn't it be really fun if she just had done that? Just like, I'm going to just dump some of my personal effects in my neighbor's yard and disappear. Like,
yeah.
And then he'd get pinned for the murder. It would be
cinematic.
It would be a great story, but I feel sad that, like, that's probably not that.
No,
the case.
That's definitely not. So no. The trial drags on, and from October well into December, the lawyers, they're battling it out. And by the time it gets turned over to the jury, they deliberate for 3 days. On December 21st, the jury returned their verdict. They found him guilty of murder in the first degree. Later, this same jury spends 4 hours together, and they decide to sentence him to life in prison.
Mm-hmm.
On March 1st, 1960, Elle enters San Quentin prison. And from there, on the honor block, Elle continues to defend himself. He's joined in his efforts by a woman named Ruth Majorana, a legal secretary who believes in his innocence and just basically steadfastly advocates for him.
She's not one of those women with a crush, right?
Yeah, I think she is. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Now, despite having been sentenced to life in prison, one of the grim realities is that Elle actually is aging and the prison system has little interest in caring for or accommodating his needs as he is. And so 1974, he's given a parole date, which he turns down. He claims it's because if he's released on parole, it would mean some sort of admission of guilt.
Hmm.
And in 1976, they offer parole again, but again, he turns it down. And finally, though, they're like, sorry, dude, no, you gotta go. And on March 26, 1978, he's out.
So he got out.
Yes. Now, so he's living. He's got like very little money, no connections. He's impoverished. You know, this is the life that like Al didn't really want. Right. So
then he should have just been married to the nice woman who got $200,000 a year and had a nice, cozy life.
Yeah. Would it not have been great for her?
No, that would not have been great for her. Well, but you can do that and not be a terrible person.
I don't think he's capable. No. So, but interest in him during this time, it's still really high. He's giving interviews, and also Diane Wagner is like deciding to, you know, cover this case in her book. And for this, she interviews plenty of people, including L himself. Now, Wagner says that in 1984, L requested that she travel to his place, which is an efficiency apartment in LA, vastly different from the home he shared with Evelyn. He enticed Diane there by saying that he had something important to tell her. And by this point, Al was aging and had trouble moving around. But there, like with her tape recorder going, Al makes his confession.
And she's the one who wrote the book, right?
Yes. Okay. So he tells Wagner that on the night after they test drove the car, Evelyn prepared for bed. He said that he entered the bedroom and didn't say a word before he raised a rubber mallet and hit her on top of the head. She had enough time to realize what was happening and had raised her hands to protect herself. He then said he took her body and wrapped it in a tarp and then put her in the car and drove to Las Vegas, arriving the next day around dusk. There, he says, 6 miles east of the Sands Hotel, he dug her grave, going down 6 feet and burying her there. When Wagner asked Elle if he ever regretted it, he said he didn't. Again, claiming that he thought Evelyn might be trying to poison him. He said that he never wanted to marry her and that, in fact, he disliked her.
He might have disliked her, but he wanted to marry her.
Right.
Yeah. Like he had a motive.
He had a motive to marrying her. Now, L died in 1987 alone in a convalescent hospital. He had no known survivors and his body went unclaimed for weeks. He is buried in a different city, but it's clear that no one close to him was there for him at his time of death. Now, Evelyn's case made history, but Evelyn herself is still missing. Rumors had swirled for years that she was buried on the northbound on-ramp for Sunset Boulevard of the San Diego Highway, which was under construction when she disappeared, and just blocks from her house. They said that the sound your car makes going onto this ramp is actually Evelyn's ghost. So in many ways, residents of Los Angeles still remember her, but, you know, in that way. And her case, though, is still occasionally mentioned when other murder without bodies cases come through.
So what is the sound? Is it a different sound that the road makes there?
I think so, yeah. So it's like Evelyn's ghost, right? But what all of that really does is it reduces Evelyn to, like, what happened to her. And not who she was as a person. And so I just really want to remember Evelyn at her parties, greeting her friends.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Speak, Spectre, about Evelyn Throsby, 63, missing since May 16th, 1955, from Los Angeles, California. There's a shrine for women, like you, courtrooms of conviction, whose bruised bodies cannot speak, whose asylum is the same dirt and gravel, who must crawl up palm over palm to deliver their message. He's the nightmare man, they'd say. Ragtag, his coat common and threadbare, his silken tongue turning vinegar into honey. My grandmother knew men like this too, and the neighbors would say she was unlucky, in love, as though she constructed these dark nests on her own. We wish we could breathe life back into your lungs, built new shrines, pearlescent and glistening. We don't need your confession, but if we drove swiftly over the Sunset Boulevard ramp and listened, maybe we could hear you once again.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.